right, very good. I have some handouts over here. We'll get started. Okay, this should be enough for everybody. All right, we'll hand it just, this will be the central repository for the handouts for anybody who wants to take one. And move them to the back. Okay.
So I have a question on last week.
You have a question before we get started? Okay, yeah. Good. That's a good way to begin.
Aaron was telling me that before a American court gives an injunction, they look into the substance of the issues. So that's not quite consistent with your idea of the American courts not really being involved in a case where you want the best thing to handle things.
Well, there is the option when somebody files for an injunction from an American court, because I've seen applications for injunctions that include this language, there is the option to include language saying we want the emergency relief, but in terms of the ultimate adjudication of this case, if the other party is prepared to adjudicate the substantive issues in front of a Betin, then we are prepared to submit to the jurisdiction of a Betin. So I've seen that language in applications for injunctive relief in accordance with this halakhic framework. And then all that the American court will do, if they feel that there is enough basis, based on the ex parte application, is they will grant the emergency relief, the TRO, but they don't immediately adjudicate the case when they issue the TRO. That's the whole point of the injunction, that the adjudication will come later. So the American court won't insist on adjudicating the substantive claims later on in order to issue injunctive relief.
But don't they
have to make some recitation in the application?
There has to be a recitation in the application. If there isn't, they're not going to issue a TRO, meaning based upon the ex parte application of one side, there has to be something in it that, assuming the correctness of the facts as they are presented by the petitioner, there would be ample cause for the issuance of a temporary restraining order or other injunctive relief. And only on that basis will the relief be granted. But again, that's obviously not an adjudication of the case, because even an American court will not consider it to be a binding adjudication of substantive claims if both parties are not involved. And they'll issue injunctive relief based on an ex parte application without even contacting the other side at all. So clearly it's not a substantive disposition of the case. Okay, for anyone who's coming now, we do have, I believe, extra copies of the Mara Mekomas. If we don't have enough, here are a couple of extras. I made 20 copies, so I don't see 20 people just yet, although I guess we're getting a little bit closer to that number. Okay, they can also be shared. I think I'm running out. I have maybe one or two more. Okay. Now, if you look in the materials for today, I did include at the very end, there's an add-on. Normally, I have 4 pages, including the questions, and then 3 pages of Mara Mekomos. So I added today, courtesy of Amiel Nyman, who's sitting right here, that he found some book of a dubious origin. Apparently, these excerpts were taken a long time ago from some book that can't necessarily be located right now, but the name of the book is called Takanos of Rabbeinu Tam. So this goes back a very, very long time. Remember, Rabbeinu Tam was a grandson of Rashi. This goes back to the 12th century, and there are some Takanos here that appear to be targeted at individuals who take other individuals to secular court in violation of the Isser Arkos. And if you look at the English translation, there's one page with a Hebrew translate, with the actual Hebrew text alongside, this is the first page, alongside the English translation. This has to do with a cherim, with an excommunication order that was issued against the plaintiffs, Jewish plaintiffs who would take Jewish defendants to secular court. And if you look at the English translation, it sounds a little bit like Rabbeinu Tam was almost taking a view contrary to the Ramban that we had initially read, and perhaps consistent with the inferences that were drawn by the SMA, that under certain circumstances, if both parties would agree, it wasn't necessarily the end of the world to take another party to secular court. That's what it would sound like if you only read the English translation. But bear in mind that these takanos of Rabbeinu Tam, assuming the authenticity of their origin, were not actually crafted in English. Therefore, the English translation presumably is not the definitive word on what these decrees were about. So if you take a look at the English translation, it says, we have voted, this is number one, we have voted, decreed, ordained, and declared under the Cherem. This is a chayon that was being issued against individuals, that no man or woman may bring, I think it's an extra word here, mehu, so it clearly is not mehu, another proof that clearly this wasn't drafted in the English, may bring a fellow Jew before Gentile courts or exert compulsion on him through Gentiles, whether by a prince or a common man, a ruler or an inferior official, except by mutual agreement made in the presence of proper witnesses. What does this sound like? It sounds a little bit like if it was, in fact, by mutual agreement, then it would be perfectly okay, right? That they can't do it, except if it would be by mutual agreement. The thing is, though, that if you take a look at the entirety of this decree, it's a chayim, remember, this really appears to be targeted against the individuals who were taking others to secular court in a fashion of mesira, right? Because here we talk about Bali Lashon Hara, Misoros, those who are Moser, somebody else, to the court. And remember, that was a major problem during the Middle Ages, that people who had a grievance against somebody else would just hand them over to the criminal authorities to be punished for some offense that they didn't commit, or to have their money confiscated, when in fact they didn't do anything that would warrant their money to be confiscated. That was called Mesira, and Mesira was considered to be grounds even for capital punishment. Therefore, you can understand that it would be certainly grounds for a cherem. So if you're going to be placing a cherem upon somebody for doing something by the Jewish courts and the Jewish authorities, so if you're going to be placing a cherem against one Jew for forcibly placing the fate of another Jew in front of a secular government or secular court system that might be very hostile towards that individual, you would understand that the cherem would make the most sense in circumstances in which one Jew was causing that other Jew to be involuntarily turned over to those officials for purposes of a cherem, just like Mesira would typically apply to what type of case? Where one Jew would turn over another Jew to criminal authorities based on the pretense that this other individual had committed some sort of crime. That's why there are authorities nowadays, like the Tzitzeliezer, the Aruch HaShulchan, who say that many of these laws are not applicable if you're dealing with a just government, where somebody has committed an actual crime and they're being turned over based on commission of an actual crime. There might be other problems with doing it if it's gratuitous, or if the person turning over the other Jew is not hired by the government for that particular purpose, like somebody who serves as a district attorney or an assistant district attorney. Maybe it's just considered to be something that's not a nice and necessary thing to do, that you don't always have to find if your neighbor is not paying all of their taxes. It's not necessarily a mitzvah to call up the IRS and say, oh, I think that my neighbor isn't necessarily being 100% honest with respect to their taxes, please arrest them. Maybe if it's your job, then you have no choice but to do it. But that's a different story. But in terms of a cherem, so that would be primarily applicable to an individual who was turning over another Jewish person to the secular court or government to be treated in a discriminatory or hostile fashion. But let's say that it was a case where both Jews agreed that they're going to adjudicate their case in front of civil court. So even if that's something that, according to Torah law, as the Ramban points out, is completely usur, is completely forbidden, even based on the consent of both parties, it wouldn't necessarily be grounds for a cherem. It wouldn't necessarily be grounds for the one Jew who was bringing the other Jew to court to be excommunicated, because the other Jew had agreed to be brought to court in that case. It's by mutual consent. Well, if you think about it that way, it would have perhaps made sense for this takana, since it was the takana against Mesira in general, not to be about when you're allowed to bring a case in front of a secular court, but when there would be a cherem imposed upon somebody for bringing a case to secular court. So you'll say, well, that's a very nice interpretation, but that's not what the words say. Because the words say that nobody may bring a fellow Jew before a Gentile court except by mutual agreement. Isn't that what the words say? Yes, so the answer is that's what the words say in English. But now let's take a look at the Hebrew, okay? So the Hebrew corresponding sentence is paragraph number one, okay? What does it say in the Hebrew over here? V'nimninu, v'gamarnu, v'nidinu, v'acharamnu. We have placed what? We have placed a cherem. We've placed a cherem. We've placed a cherem. We've gathered together and we voted and we've decided to place a cherem, an excommunication, a ban. I'll call ish v'isha krovim or rechokim, and anybody. Asher yavias chaveru b'dine goyim or yekufeno ayde goyim. Anybody who forces somebody to have their fate placed in front of the non-Jewish courts or hein sar or government, hein hedyot, hein moshel, hein sradyot, im lo midashneim b'fnei edim uksherim. Unless it happened to be done by mutual consent. Do you find that this sentence says anything at all about when it's allowed and when it's not allowed? Do you see that in the Hebrew? Does that appear in the Hebrew? Pray tell, I ask all of you. No, absolutely not. So therefore, you see the dangers of relying upon English translation in general. It's always good to look at the primary sources. What a difference, you know, a translation can make. The translation makes it sound as if Rabbeinu Tam and his cohorts were actually permitting two people by mutual consent to go to secular court. Not at all what the Hebrew text says whatsoever. Just the question of when the chayim would be applicable, when the chayim would not be applicable. There's another page of this. Right, but this has nothing to do with when it's permitted. This has to do with when are we placing a cherem. Saying we're only placing a cherem if it's being done forcibly against the person's will, as opposed to a case where it was done by mutual consent. This says this is not speaking at all about whether that would be permissible or not. It's just talking about when the cherem would be applicable. Right? That's all. It's only talking about when the cherem would be applicable. That's correct. And we have the same thing. We have the same thing in the Hebrew translator in the text of the Takana on the next page. I have to find where this is it's the second paragraph. The second paragraph as well is talking about if you take a look at the second paragraph beginning with Tzatz HaMateh. Tzatz HaMateh, okay? And the fourth word on the third line of the second paragraph, v'nimninu u'v'gamarnu, same lashon, v'charamnu kol ish v'isha shiyavo shiyavi chaveru b'yad goyim sar moshel sradi v'hedyot im lo midashneim v'edim shem. Exactly the same thing. It's really the word for word, pretty much the same language. Again, only referring to when is the cherem applicable, not referring to permissibility or impermissibility. So this was brought to my attention by Rav Amiel, and this appeared to be this startling discovery, as if Rabbeinu Tam was disagreeing with the Ramban. However, it appears that was not the case based on the actual Hebrew wording, which I suspected. I was suspicious when I looked at the English translation, so it was good we went back to the Hebrew. So now let's talk about what we're up to in terms of looking at the source materials. Where I'd like to delve into at this point in time would be a little bit of a discussion, even though this is a topic that relates to a large degree about the substantive adjudication of cases, and we're really talking right now about jurisdictional issues, about what type of cases are accepted by the Beit Din, when a case is beyond the Beit Din's purview, when something should be referred to secular court, and when it's permissible to do so, and so forth. But because of the fact that this issue really relates to both jurisdictional issues and also touches incidentally as well upon substantive adjudication, I feel that this is an apt time to bring it up, and that's the general topic of Dina D'Malchus HaDina, the law of the land. Dina D'Malchus HaDina, because sometimes the question, you can pose the question, is it appropriate for a Beis Din to decline a case altogether based on this being within the framework of something which should be exclusively within the province of the law of the land? And if that's the case, maybe Beis Din should sometimes withdraw from hearing a case based on Dina D'Malchus HaDina considerations. Yes?
Do they discuss the values of a benign government with a relatively honest judicial system, which is set up the law in accordance with Dine B'nai Noach?
So every single secular population is obligated, according to the laws of B'nai Noach, in the mitzvah of dinim. That's one of the seven mitzvahs of B'nai Noach. Dinim means that they're supposed to set up their own court system. But that's a court system that's binding upon all the non-Jews. The Jews are still obligated to have the Batei Din.
It's a benign system.
Benign?
Yeah.
Okay, it's benign.
A just system.
You mean if it's a just system, so that's what they're supposed to do. They're not supposed to set up an unjust system. They're supposed to set up a just system. But we're still not supposed to use that system, even if it's just.
Bresden always takes precedence.
Bresden always takes precedence, according to Jewish law. But we're going to examine and see whether there are cases where maybe that wouldn't be true.
Told us that in cases of suspected molestation, we should go to the police.
Ah, so we spoke about this before. We said, when is it that Bresden has jurisdiction? That's in the civil realm. Whenever you have civil cases, like monetary cases, things of that sort. But whenever you have criminal cases, so that's a governmental function to handle criminal cases. It depends on the government of any country in which you're living. Because remember, the parties there are never, it's never between one Jew and another Jew. Whenever there's a criminal action, the action is not, even if, let's say, you assault somebody else, or I assault somebody else, not you in particular. So the action would not be between the person who's the victim and the person who's the assailant. The action would be the government against the assailant. It's always the government who is the party. So since the government is the party, the government is not bound by the system of Batei Din, especially if you're not dealing with a Jewish government. Jewish government might be a different story, but if it's not a Jewish government, so that by definition is outside of the framework of the Batei Din, because that's their function and they're a critical party to the case. It's not between the victim and the assailant. So that's a very important distinction between the criminal realm and the civil realm. So that's why if there would be a child molestation case and it came to our attention, we would refuse to handle the case. What's a more difficult question is, what if the person says, well, I'm not, you know, I don't want to bring to the Besdin the criminal action because I know that the Besdin can't put the molester behind bars or take criminal action against the child, the alleged child molester, but I just wanted to receive damages. I just want to receive monetary tort damages for being molested. So there the question becomes, is it possible for the Besdin realistically to bifurcate the criminal action from the civil action? And if it's impossible to really adjudicate the civil action without also adjudicating the criminal action, then that also becomes off limits for the Besdin. So sometimes a Besdin has to decline even a monetary action if the monetary action is inextricably intertwined with the criminal action. And that's why, for the most part, it's very, very difficult for a Besdin to cure, you know, a child molestation case, unless it's already been adjudicated criminally in the criminal court system. And now it's only a question that after it's already been found that somebody is guilty of molestation, then the person afterwards wants to bring a monetary case in Besdin for damages so that a Besdin would be able to handle. A Besdin could actually be able to handle that type of a case.
Is there a statute of limitations in civil court for even such things? Because if it is, then...
We spoke about statute of limitations last time. We said statute of limitations is not applicable to Besdin, except maybe in terms of presumptions of who has the burden of proof if somebody only brings a case after a statute of limitations has passed. So that could create a suspicion that maybe the case, maybe that person's case is not as strong as would otherwise be assumed if there hadn't been a statute of limitations.
But then the molestation case could be heard by Besdin if it's past the statute of limitations for civil.
Ha ha ha. So that's a different question. So that becomes very, very different.
You know, 30 years ago, the priest becomes very difficult. You know, molested me.
First of all, the statutes of limitations for criminal molestation cases have been extended considerably over the years. Okay, so it goes on for a pretty long time. If the statute of limitations has, in fact, expired, so then there would be more of an argument. Yes, then there would probably be more of an argument that even if the civil case was tied up with an action that typically would have to be brought criminally, if it could no longer be brought criminally, then you could make more of an argument that the civil case under those circumstances could be brought to the Besdin. Yes?
Yeah, so doesn't that come in conflict with the laws of Dinah Mechus HaDinah, because Dinah Mechus HaDinah says there is a restriction because of statute of limitations. So how could the Beis Din go against Dinah Mechus HaDinah?
It depends how you define Dinah Mechus HaDinah. So let's try to do that a little bit. So here I'm going to frame one question jurisdictionally, but we're also going to include your question as well in our analysis.
What's the Beis Din that does the investigation if they can't do anything criminal? What's the purpose of even hearing the case then? Well, turning it over
no, for a Bezdin can examine, can investigate the facts of the case. If the Bezdin, if the there's no criminal action that has to go to the court system, either because the case was not criminal in nature or because the criminal action was already decided or because the courts are not going to handle it for one reason or another, as was just mentioned, so then the purpose of the Bezdin handling the case and doing its factual investigation would be for determining monetary damages. Okay, now, so the question that I pose, this is a real-life question that comes up quite a bit in terms of Bezdin practice, is when one of the parties has declared bankruptcy. Bankruptcy is something which, you know, has a clear Dina de Malchus de Dina component. For those, by the way, who are uninitiated just in terms of the term, Dina de Malchus de Dina, Dina Malchus de Dina means the law of the land. The law of the land is the law. That's Dina de Malchus de Dina, the law of the land is the law. Okay, and we have to discuss the parameters. We discussed it a little bit. We touched upon it when we read the Tshuvas HaRashba, remember? Okay, so Reuven summons a corporation wholly owned by Shimon to Beit Din, and also summons a Shimon. So there's a corporation owned by Shimon, and there's Shimon himself. In the meantime, Shimon declares bankruptcy. Now Shimon is subject to an automatic stay, according to American law, right? He's subject to an automatic stay, which means that nobody is allowed to go after Shimon for his assets in a regular civil court, and certainly not in an arbitration tribunal, because Shimon is subject to an automatic stay. He has to be left alone. If there's any action, then the action has to be registered. In the bankruptcy proceeding, any person who's a creditor who thinks that they have any rights against Shimon, they have to file what's known as a proof of claim. Okay, they have to file a proof of claim, but they can't initiate a lawsuit against him. So are there any limitations in terms of the involvement of Beit Din in the case? So in other words, let's say Reuven comes to Beit Din and Reuven says, I want you to send the hazmana against Shimon. So should the Beit Din say, we're not going to send the hazmana because it's subject to an automatic stay? Or do we say, no, we have a separation between religion and state, and just because the state is not going to issue any court actions against Shimon at this point in time, that doesn't forestall the ability of the Beit Din to exercise its religious freedom and to issue a religious summons against Shimon, even though this is for a monetary action. So this has happened a couple of times. There was one bankruptcy case a few years ago in which a court imposed sanctions upon a plaintiff because the defendant was subject to an automatic stay, and the plaintiff brought an action in Beit Din against this defendant who was subject to an automatic stay, and the Beit Din even issued a seiruv, issued a contempt order, because the debtor who was subject to the automatic stay, the bankruptcy debtor, refused to submit to Beit Din, and the Beit Din issued a contempt order. And then the lawyers for the debtor had to petition the Beit Din to remove the seiruv, you know, based on arguing there was an automatic stay and bringing actions in order to have the case removed from Beit Din. Eventually it was removed from Beit Din, but the debtor incurred a lot of fees in the meantime by virtue of the lawyers having to spend a lot of time dealing with this. And then the debtor petitioned to the bankruptcy court to have the plaintiff sanctioned and to have the plaintiff responsible to pay for all of the attorney fees that were incurred by the debtor in defending this Beit Din action that was initiated following his bankruptcy. And the court ruled. The court ruled at the time that the plaintiff was in fact responsible to pay for the debtor's attorney's fees. As a result of doing this, there was an action brought at that point in time by the debtor claimed that this was the plaintiff's claim that this was a violation of their religious rights of separation between religion and state, but they never really pursued that claim, and therefore it wasn't dealt with in the court action. But it was dealt with more recently. This past year there was another similar case. Here there was no seiruv that was issued, but there was an ikul, an injunction. And we're speaking about the injunction. So it was an injunction issued by a Beit Din. It was a Beit Din in Muncie that issued an ikul. What happened was that the debtor declared bankruptcy, and then, you know, a debtor in bankruptcy is allowed to bring in bankruptcy court any causes of action that the debtor has against third parties. So the debtor brought a number of third parties who were religious to the bankruptcy, to include them in litigation in the bankruptcy court for claims that the debtor had. The debtor's name was Birkat Yosef, Yeshivat Birkat Yosef, and Yeshivat Birkat Yosef brought a number of these parties who are all religious parties to court to recover various monies that the bankruptcy debtor claimed had been fraudulently taken away from the debtor. And then what the plaintiffs did is they turned around and said, why, you're taking us to secular court? We're Jews. We don't belong in secular court. We're religious Jews. So they turned around and summoned the bankruptcy debtor in Beis Din. And the Beis Din promptly issued an ikul, an injunction against these other parties, saying that, an injunction against the debtor, saying that the debtor had no right to pursue the action in bankruptcy court, and these actions that the debtor had against these other parties could only be pursued in Beis Din, and therefore the debtor had to drop these actions immediately in bankruptcy court and bring the case to the Beis Din, and the Beis Din even threatened to issue a seiruv against the bankruptcy debtor. Bankruptcy debtor took not only these other parties, who turned out to be, you know, plaintiffs in the Beis Din action, but they were defendants in the bankruptcy court action, took these other parties to bankruptcy court, claiming that they had violated the automatic stay, and that the debtor was entitled to costs and relief and damages based on their violation of the automatic stay, and also took the Beis Din to the bankruptcy court, saying that the Beis Din was responsible to pay damages, and made a request that all of the rulings of the Beis Din should be declared null and void, which is sort of an interesting...
In that case.
Right, even though the Beis Din didn't actually have jurisdiction, but wanted the equal of the Beis Din to be declared null and void by the bankruptcy court. And guess what the bankruptcy court did? This is the bankruptcy court of the Southern District in New York. This case is called Birkat Yosef, if you want to look it up. So the bankruptcy court ruled in favor of the debtor. Rule number one, that the plaintiffs were responsible, that these other parties who were, you know, the plaintiffs in the Beis Din action were responsible to pay costs and damages to the debtor. It declined to obligate the Beis Din in damages because it said we don't really want to go there. But it had it also went so far as to declare any of the edicts that were issued by the Beis Din null and void, which is kind of a very interesting, right? You would think so. So then there's a lengthy discussion in this court case by the court about the argument of the Establishment Clause issue, and the court cited, you may guess at the Supreme Court case that was cited by the bankruptcy court to justify why they thought that this was not an Establishment Clause issue. It was issued by one of the heroes of the Frum community, except he wasn't considered so heroic when it came to this one decision that he wrote, which is called Aragon versus Smith. There was a decision of Justice Scalia, where Justice Scalia, certainly joined in the decision if he didn't write it. I remember if he wrote it, he may have written it. And that decision says that if there is a secular principle or a principle or there is a law that implicates neutral principles that just incidentally happens to impact upon religious practice, that's not a violation of the Establishment Clause. So the court argued that having the automatic stay is not targeted at religious practice. That is a law of neutral principles. It's not religious in nature. And in a case like this, it might incidentally burden religious belief and religious practice in terms of burdening the ability of a Jewish party to be able to utilize the rabbinical courts of his or her own faith. And therefore, since it's only incidental burdening of religious practice, it would not be a violation of the Establishment Clause, according to Aragon versus Smith. There was an author who actually was an intern of mine at the Beis Din of America long ago. His name is Avi Helfand. He's now a professor in California Law School. I think it's called Pepperdine. He wrote a lengthy law review article that got cited in this case, in which he had previously argued that in the event that this should ever happen, court should not interfere with the Beis Din practice. So the courts actually cited the article, which is very nice if you're a law school professor to get your case cited. It's like a big deal, but they soundly rejected his reasoning, saying that they completely disagreed with the author. I think that by now what happened, I think I saw this in the last couple of months, that case was actually appealed. It went to an appellate court, particularly based on the religious grounds, but it wasn't appealed by the parties. It was appealed by third parties, like by religious organizations, appealed it, and the appeal was struck down primarily because of the fact that the people who filed the appeal didn't really have standing in the case, so because the actual parties didn't seem to file the appeal. I've subsequently gathered more information. It's gotten a lot more complicated since then because some of the parties actually did enter into separate arbitration agreements with the debtor to actually transfer some of the proceedings to Beis Din. That part is extremely complicated. I don't know fully what's going on. I spoke at length with one of the attorneys, but if I have more information about later developments, I'll let you know. But that's where the case seems to stand at this point in time. So this is very, very relevant. So now we know. What do we know about this? You know that the courts clearly care about this. They clearly are not pleased with the interference of Batei Din when it comes to a bankruptcy matter where there is an automatic stay. It doesn't matter whether they care, whether they don't care. Is that dispositive at all in terms of the decision of the Beis Din to get involved when it comes to bankruptcy matters? So this is a yes, you have a question.
What if it's the trustee getting involved on behalf of the debtor? So if a trustee is seeking to recover funds from a frum person on behalf of the bankruptcy estate in theory, but really they're bringing an action, they're stepping in the shoes, does that circumvent the whole issue or no?
Well, the Beis Din didn't seem to think so. The Beis Din seemed to feel that it was really the debtor who, you know, was involved with this. It's a question. Where is the trustee generally is involved in Chapter 7 cases, not Chapter 11 cases, you know, so maybe this was a Chapter 11 case. Where there wouldn't necessarily have been a trustee, that gets to some of the minutiae of a bankruptcy law. What exactly is the issue to begin with? So Dina de Malchusa Dina, we saw from the Rashba, is not automatically a sweeping catch-all principle that says that we put the Torah laws aside whenever there happens to be a secular court system. There have to be some limitations with respect to Dina de Malchusa Dina. So let's go through some of the sources here, starting from source base. We're going to skip over source Aleph right now. We'll get back to that a little bit later. Source Aleph just being, you know, the general prohibition of bringing cases in front of the secular courts. Now, if you go to source base, this is the one place where the Chuvas HaRashba actually gets quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. This is a quotation from the Ramah. It says here Shulchan Aruch, but it's really a quotation from the Ramah. Kol hanose isha das minag nose v'nidon adavah v'dinei ovei kakarim t'imesa yorsha bailo k'delma lezev leka v'zeh mishum dinan d'malchusa. So he says that if you're following the laws, he says anybody who is tries to invoke Dina de Malchusa when it comes to matters of Yerusha, Dina de Malchusa is not applicable. Why is Dina de Malchusa not applicable? The law aminan Dina de Malchusa lebedavah sheyesh bo hanol lemelech. We only say Dina de Malchusa if the king, if the government, gets some sort of a benefit, oshu letakanas b'nei hamedina, or there is some type of economic regulation that has some sweeping public policy purpose that's going to affect the entirety of the population. But not that all matters are supposed to be governed according to the laws of the nations of the world. Because then we would have to, like the Rashba says, then there would be nothing left of Torah law. But it does sound like the Ramah is including a lot, because he says anything which is l'takanas b'nei ha-medina, anything which has a sweeping public policy ramifications, that would be included. What does it mean that would be included? It sounds like it would be included even when it comes to dealings between two Jewish parties. We would have to incorporate into our halakhic framework what the Dina de Malchusa Dina says if it is some type of a sweeping economic regulation. So now, in terms of defining what the Ramah means and what are the applications of the Ramah, so this is where other authorities kind of weigh in and try to figure this out. So you have the Sma. So the Sma says, well, you know, if you look at what the, I don't have this quoted, if you look at what the Ramah had cited earlier of three sifim, three paragraphs earlier in the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah had said, he had quoted from the Mechaber. The Mechaber had said, we only apply Dina de Malchusa Dina when it comes to like taxes, that you have to pay your taxes and things of that sort. When it comes to other matters, like, you know, any contractual matters and the like between individuals, so then Dina de Malchusa Dina doesn't really apply. It really depends on two different opinions that are found in the Gemara and in Maseches Gittin and Daf Yud Amud Beis, so it's really dependent upon that discussion. So we're not going to, you know, get into we're not going to get into that Gemara. But there are these two basic opinions. We're going to focus on the Ramah, who accepts the more lenient opinion that we say Dina de Malchusa Dina, even with respect to all financial matters. So there, the Ramah said that it applies to everything. So he says v'shakenu ikar, and that this really is the way that we would paskin. So he says mashakasa b'chol davar, that when the Ramah says that we apply Dina de Malchusa Dina with respect to everything, it doesn't really mean everything. It means that even if it's not just relating to taxation, the haraya and And as a proof, the Gamma Darchi Moshe Kosta Tzkila Shadasa Mordechai B'Shem Toysos Amina Mechol Dara Dina Malchus Adina. The proof is that he quoted to Mordechai that said that we say about everything Dina Malchus Adina. And then afterwards he says, no, Haina, look at the very end, Haina Davka Lian Arhago Shemishpatei Malachim. It doesn't really apply to everything. It just really applies to things that have a broad public policy ramifications. So what does that mean then? What would have broad public policy ramifications? Well, one would think bankruptcy is something which has very broad public policy ramifications, right? That's something that affects everybody. Securities violations might have, you know, such broad ramifications as well, right? So these are things that would seem to perhaps be folded into what the Ramah is talking about. So you look at the shach. There's a long shach. We won't go through the entire thing. Just you should know about the shach. A shach in Siman Ayin Gimel Sifkat and Lamites. There it's talking about a certain enactment of the Dinah de Malchusa that if you had a loan that was extended, so the lender is not allowed to dispose of the collateral for purposes of helping pay for the loan until after 1 year has passed, and whether this is something that should be binding upon the Jewish population as well. So if you go down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines, okay, the Shaka quotes the two different major opinions of Rishonim about whether Dina de Malchusa Dina is only applicable to things like property taxes and income taxes, or whether it's applicable to even more things as well that are for purposes of a public public policy regulation. So he says at the end of Benira Be'enai, so this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down, Nira Be'enai Shlonema Dina de Malchusa Dina Lebedorim Shalmel Gozel Anasuk Amitzim Amkse Yoski Yoseben. So one opinion says it only applies to taxes. But if I have a dispute, I have an adjudication between one Jew and another Jew, so whenever I'm not dealing with the general population, not dealing with the government wanting to take taxes from me, but I'm just dealing with a dispute, a claim, an argument between one Jew and another Jew, so of course that's only subject to Torah law and not subject to Dina de Malchusa. Dina de Malchusa doesn't apply to disputes between two Jews. But he says that's according to the opinion that says that it only relates to taxes. But then he goes on to say, Lafilu, even according to other poskim, the Sovereign that Dina de Malchusa Bechol Dover, like the Ramah cites, that Dina de Malchusa applies to other matters, the sweeping economic regulation, Hainu Davka, Ma She'enu Neged Din Torah Seinu, La She'enu Mefurash Etzleinu. That's only with respect to things in which we do not have any kind of legal precedent. Some say, for example, that maybe when it comes to corporation law, that we don't have corporation law. Others argue and say, what do you mean we don't have corporation law? We have the laws of what relates to Hekdesh, and Hekdesh was like a corporation, and Torah is hafakwa ve'hafakwa dekolaba, that if you keep on looking, you'll find everything. You'll find everything, even Coca-Cola. You'll find everything in Torah, right? Kolaba. Everything is in Torah. So there's nothing that's not included. But the Shakal asks for the possibility, maybe there'll be certain laws that are going to be enacted that you'll never find any kind of precedent in Torah, and that's where, even between Jew, two Jews, we would apply Dina de Malchusa Dina. But otherwise, we would never apply Dina de Malchusa Dina if it was just a dispute between two Jews. That's what the Shach seems to say, and that would very much limit the principle. But if you turn to the next page, here we have a Beis Yosef. Okay, the Beis Yosef quotes from Rabbeinu Yaakov Yisrael, and this is a very, very important quote. It really is similar to something which Rabbeinu Yonah says in Baba Basra as well. He says, Rabbeinu, he's also talking about same type of principle that you have a lender who loaned money, and the question is whether if the Din de Malchusa says that the lender is not allowed to dispose of the collateral until after 1 year, whether we're bound by that or not. Same sort of, they were all talking about this this case. So he quotes Rabbeinu Yaakov Yisrael, and he says, just go to the next line. Menidon didon pshita de lo shayak dina de malchusa mamashin masim asvaros in bali aribis dina de malchusa dina should not be applicable to this law about the collateral. Why? The fisha eno chok kabur lekamonim. Number one, this is not a statute that had previously appeared anywhere. Veino kosim bini museim adarabu negedatam. In fact, this is something which went against their own religious principles. But the eno chok kloli lekol amalchus, and he says, and it's not something which is applicable to everybody. Elamalva beribis bovad, only people who loan with interest, or the shatagarim, not other merchants. Ve'od, and this is the most important part. This is the ve'od. So focus on the ve'od here for a second. Ve'od, she'ein asrar machrachas she'imko hamashkonas. It's not as if they really care that the collateral must be sold. Elano senes lo v'shus. They just say that this is an option that you have. But if you don't want to exercise the option, you don't have to. B'chol she'enu machriach, enu dina d'malchusa. And something which they do not care. They just stipulate in their books that this is how a certain law should be or would be carried out. But they don't say you have to carry it out a certain way. That's not dina d'malchusa. K'mo le'locho, le'lechol arab elabigarta, shemach makbid al-kap. Like, for example, to say that you're not allowed to remain on your property unless you pay the property tax. You know what happens if you don't pay the property tax? They seize your property. So does that show that they care? They really care about this. If they're going to seize your property, they care. But here, you want to keep the collateral, they don't care. You want to sell the collateral, they don't care. They're just giving you the reshus, they're giving you the option. Okay? So what the Beis Yosef is articulating is what I believe to be a very cogent application of the Dina D'Malchusa Dina law when it comes to economic regulation. Do they care, or are they just providing an option? Like, for example, the Dina D'Malchusa Dina might say that this is one way in which this is how you're supposed to go about a monetary transaction between two parties. Let's say two parties decide they're going to conduct a monetary transaction in a different way. That it says they'll have in their law books, their commercial code, that a transaction is not binding unless you have unless it's written down on a contract, and unless you have unless you have a clear transfer of money that is going to earn you the right to have merchandise sent over to you. And there would be nothing in the commercial code, for example, that would say that there's a binding transaction that would be created between two parties if you have two merchants in the diamond district who shake on a deal and they say mazal u'bracha. That wouldn't be binding under the commercial code. But if a Jewish court decides this is going to be binding because this is the practice of Jewish merchants, is the government going to care that we decided that this is binding? They're saying, we don't care. We were just creating a framework for enforceable transactions. You decide amongst yourselves that this is going to be enforceable anyway. We don't care. We're not makpid. So what the Beis Yosef is saying, quoting these various authorities, is that if they don't care, then it's not included in Dina D'Malchusa Dina. You know who else says this, I think, pretty clearly? The Yechavidas, Rav Avadya Yosef. Let's look at Rav Avadya Yosef in source 6 over here, source book. He quotes from a Chidah. Chidah, we know, was one of the great authorities of, I don't know when he lived, the 18th century or so. Gamalom Isin the Marana Chidah Besefer Tuvai, and I think he was 18th century. He was a Gaon Atzum. Chidah was unbelievable. He was a fundraiser. He used to run from like country to country collecting monies for yeshivas, and sometimes he found the time, somehow he found the time to write something like 40 svarim. And not only did he write 40 svarim, but they're amazing svarim. Amazing in terms of their scope, in terms of their clarity, in terms of their progressive nature. He was just absolutely amazing, the Chidah. Anyway, he was asked, Odos Mishavatsa Ladun Be'arkos Medina Yerusha Uvabatayna Shaldina Demachusa Dina. Right? Somebody was asked, should all order, inheritance law matters, again, the Rashba's issue, should they follow Dina Demachusa Dina? Beheshiv Shomu Shemayim Azos. He answered appropriately that, the heavens will, cry out over such a terrible suggestion. Shrei Pasuk Rashba B'tshuva. Remember, I pointed out to you, this is why we read the Rashba inside, that the focal point of almost any discussion about Dina D'Malchusa Dina is that Tshuva of the Rashba. See, everybody cites their Rashba. The question is what the Rashba means, but everybody cites him. At least for this principle, She'en Alacha Zu Shayakas B'dina Yerusha Sfinachos, Dina D'Malchusa Dina doesn't apply to these types of laws regarding inheritance. Gambalavach, and then he goes on to say as follows, Gambalavach Ilo Shayak Lomar Dina D'Malchusa Dina, Elo what? Elo, Kishahamelech goes there, Akob Benamin Dinoso, the Kofi Aleim, the Kayim Gzeiroso. It's only when what? What's the translation of those words? Only when the government really cares about something. If I have a family that decides that the way in which they're going to handle their inheritance is in accordance with Torah law, and all the members of the family agree that this is the way that it's going to be adjudicated, and this is the way that it's going to be handled, even if it's not in accordance with secular inheritance law, does the government care? Is the government going to reallocate all of the resources as a result of the fact that Torah inheritance law was followed? No! They don't care. They'll say, you want to privately contract in a way that's different from the secular law? We don't care. We're not makpid. It's your your money, do what you want with your money, the government will say, okay? It's fine. But it's only din in the machusa, when if you don't follow what the government says, they're going to be angry at you. They're going to have a quarrel with you, okay? As opposed to over here, where the government's not going to care, okay? Now, this is going to be applicable to a host of different situations where the government is not going to care. So just skip the next source for a moment, okay? The next source, and go to source number 8, okay? Which is a tshuva by Rav Moshe Feinstein having to do with whether, this was a tshuva not relating to America, this had to do with Switzerland, and it had to do with whether Jewish creditors were obligated to comply with bankruptcy, with Switzerland bankruptcy law. Meaning that, did they have to follow the rules regarding the priority of who would be allowed to collect first and who collects second and so forth, where the priority rules of bankruptcy law, to the extent the creditors would get to create to collect at all, maybe they'd only get 20 cents on the dollar, whatever they would get, but if they would get something, they would have to wait in line and only collect according to the priority system of secular law. And the debtor in this case was a Jewish debtor, and one of the creditors was a Jewish creditor, and the Jewish creditor said, it's nice if everybody else wants to follow secular law, because they're all non-Jews, they can follow their own secular bankruptcy law. I want to follow Torah law, which means that he owes me money, I'm entitled to collect. So I want to just jump in and collect first, have him pay me first, then he can pay everybody else afterwards. Am I bound by the priority rules of a general secular bankruptcy law? And Rav Moshe Feinstein ruled, yes, okay? And when Rav Moshe was explaining why Dinin de Malchusa would be applicable to this case, so he starts off with a very, very important discussion. The reason why, one of the main reasons that I have source 7, go back for a moment to source 7, is based on the first sentence of what Rav Moshe says over there, or I believe it's around the first sentence, where it's in the middle of the first sentence. He says that it's very difficult. What you wrote, the Kavod Tarasso Arama, what the writer wrote, it's very difficult to write about these inyanim. It's difficult to talk about these inyanim. Here I'm pretending to give you, like, you know, the final word on Dinin de Malchus Sedina. But I want to explain, it's complicated, Dinin de Malchus Sedina. So I want to just make that point. If Moshe Feinstein says it's complicated, then it's really complicated, okay? Mishnei Tamim. Chad Mitam Shikosa B'Sheel Zuchuas Heishi Moshe. Quotes a book, a sefer called Heishi Moshe. Sheyesh Mevucha Rabba Bein HaPoskim. There's a lot of confusion when it comes to Dinin de Malchus Sedina, when it's applicable and when it's not applicable. It's a confusing topic, Ustiras Rabbos, and there are lots of contradictions. Ritzarek Lazer Tziyun, and it requires a lot of very careful investigation. Usman Rab, and it requires a lot of time, which is why we're going to probably spend more than just one chabur on this. Ulay Yazor Hashem Lafin Lasuke La Alaka Koshken Nektani Era Kamoni. I hope that Akash Baruch will help me understand, and certainly somebody, you know, of my low human caliber. But obviously, Rav Moshe, if he's describing himself of low caliber, that is clearly out of pure modesty, but it makes us all, feel much more foolish. But only time, and then he throws in another reason. That also, it shouldn't look like we're slighting this government, because Moshe believed that you have to have a lot of respect for the government in which you live, and he felt that America was a malchus shel chesed, and therefore he didn't want to write in ways that would appear to disparage America. It's just an important principle for poskim in general to bear in mind. We're supposed to have that sensibility that we should speak in a way in which it does not look like we're speaking derogatorily about our own government, even if there are times in which we're going to say the Torah law should govern our own personal interactions and not secular law. It shouldn't look in any way as if we are disparaging insulting the secular government or the secular legal system. So you always have to speak respectfully. It's a point that Moshe will continuously make. It behooves all of us and all rabbinic figures as well to take heed that Moshe felt that this was an important point to make. Okay, that being said, so now let's move to source 8. So Moshe says, if you look after the ellipsis in source 8, that's about four lines down, When he's talking about bankruptcy laws, he says about Nireh, Tavadai after Asovin and Dinah Machus Adina Bechol Dover, even according to those who hold like the Ramah quotes, the Dinah Machus Adina applies to everything. We explain what does everything mean. Everything means even those things that are the Takanas B'nai Medina, that are broad sweeping economic regulations that affect everybody, right? Hainu Masha Nikva, Bedina Machus Adina, Bedine Mamanos, Bedine Kinyonim. That's when it comes to establishing a uniform system in terms of how assets and become transmitted, or the way in which loans should be repaid, because this will cause grief and will cause damage to the government. If people behave in varying or divergent fashions, because when you have, for example, a bankruptcy statute, if some people will keep it and some people won't keep it, and there won't be any kind of predictability, then creditors will feel disadvantaged. Then debtors will not feel that they have a sense of security in terms of the system protecting them, and that's going to lead to a breakdown in the market in terms of people feeling comfortable engaging in commerce in the marketplace. So it's very important to have some type of a predictable system of what's going to happen to provide protections for people who are in need of protection when they will become economically vulnerable. If you're going to discriminate between the way in which you treat different people, it's going to lead to a tremendous amount of unhealthy competition and undercutting by some people of other people in Merivos and of controversies and quarrels. So he says that this is the type of thing where he can understand that the government would not want there to be a different system when it comes to these sweeping areas of economic regulation that would be practiced by any subset of the population. Because then it's going to bring into question the efficacy of the laws of the government. But whenever the government's not going to care, if we would deal with inheritance matters according to our laws, it doesn't affect the entire population how an individual inheritance is handled. Everybody bequeaths their assets according to their wishes. Or the amount of damages you're going to pay if an animal causes damage in babakama type damages. Even if they would say you're exempt and we say you're obligated, what do they care? And so too with respect to laws of guardians. Two neighbors have a property dispute with each other and they bring it to Bezdin. Then Bezdin rules in a way which is different from how secular law would have ruled. Do you think they care? They could care less, okay? Ushluchim, or laws of agency. Or if you have a husband and wife that decide that they're going to allocate their assets according to how the Bezdin decides as opposed to according to how the secular court decides, they also don't care. They just don't care. So in any area where they don't care, anybody could do what they want. That's not considered to be Takanas B'nai HaMedina. So Moshe, really, for all of the reservations of saying it's a Mavucha Rabba, it's very confusing. I think the criteria are very, very clear cut. Is it the type of thing that people would privately contract in a way that was different from the economic regulation and would wreak havoc? Or is it the type of thing that if two people say between us we're going to do things differently according to Torah law, it's not going to make any kind of a dent on the Torah, on the governmental system of economic regulation, then that would be perfectly okay. So in that framework, you can examine bankruptcy law. So Moshe says two things about bankruptcy law. He says, number one, without reading it inside, you can read it for yourself, but without reading it inside, Moshe says, number one, this is the type of thing where it affects everybody. You know, the type of predictability and framework which is created by bankruptcy law and having bankruptcy laws in place is something which people rely upon in engaging in commerce, and if some people are going to be treated differently from others, the government's really going to care about that because that's going to mess up the entire system. And number two, whenever you have a bankruptcy debtor, it's very, very common that among the creditors will be non-Jews. And since the non-Jews are not beholden to Torah law, so therefore you can't have one system for one set of creditors and another system for another set of creditors, because that's not fair, because then you'll be disadvantaging the expectations of an entire set of creditors who are entitled to rely upon the secular court system. So this comes up, for example, when we have Dinei Torah, where somebody wants to bring a bring a Jewish party to a Beis Din, but the Jewish party who is a defendant in the case is a co-defendant together with three other parties who are not Jewish, and the three other parties who are not Jewish are what we call necessary parties to the litigation. You can't properly litigate the case without bringing in all the necessary parties. The other parties say, we're not bound by Beis Din, we're not bound to go to Beis Din, so Beis Din can't then compel the one Jewish party who's a defendant to submit to Beis Din when the other necessary parties are not bound by Beis Din adjudication. So Rav Moshe uses that argument also in the bankruptcy context. So Rav Moshe says he's not talking about bankruptcy discharge, and he's not talking about, you know, whether after the bankruptcy proceeding is over, as a matter of halacha, we would say dinin de malchusa dinin, that because it's a bankruptcy discharge, therefore the debtor never has to pay his debts again, and whether that would be included in dinin de malchusa dinin. He doesn't talk about that. He doesn't talk about that. There's the famous Chokas Yaakov who says, we say dinin de malchusa dinin, but we don't say gezel de malchusa dinin. And to say that when a debtor, you know, is back on his feet and is able to pay back his old debts, that he should be discharged because the dinin de malchusa dinin says so, he says that would be considered to, that would be giving a stamp of approval on gezel, and that's not something that we're going to do. So Chokas Yaakov Reich does not accept dinin de malchusa dinin when it comes to bankruptcy discharge. But at least when it comes to the question of the automatic stay while the creditors are collecting whatever they're going to be able to collect in the priority order, so Moshe says with respect to the priority order of collection, we would apply dinin de malchusa dinin. Rav Henkin, Rav Yosef Elio Henkin, indicates that similarly, even though Rav Moshe this is source 7, but Moshe doesn't have a definitive conclusion about this. Rav Henkin says, similarly, we would apply the principle of dinin de malchusa dinin to rent control. If there are laws that say that if you rent in a certain building, the landlord is not allowed to evict the tenant if the tenant is prepared to pay a certain amount of rent, and the landlord is not allowed to raise the rent more than whatever the government allows because it's a rent-controlled building, so then it's against. So then dinin de malchusa dinin is binding on a Jewish landlord and a Jewish tenant, even if the Jewish tenant says, it's okay, you don't have to go along with rent control laws when it comes to me, it doesn't matter, because if you would have a divergence of practice when it comes to rent control laws, it would mess up the entire system, it would mess up everything that the government is trying to accomplish through this governmental regulation of not having homeless people on the streets, of not making people the burdens of the rest of society, of having everybody kick in accordance with a certain measure, and making sure that there's affordable housing for people who are poor. And this is a goal that doesn't only apply to a subset of society, it applies to all of society. So when you have these sweeping economic regulations for public policy purposes, so then that would be, Rav Henkin says, that would be something that the government has the right to enact, that would be included dinin de malchusa dinin, the government cares about it, and therefore that would become binding upon even the world of Beis Din and Jewish law as something which would be incorporated into halakha. So now, let's look at it in terms of the bankruptcy context. When there is an automatic stay, does the government care about everybody honoring this automatic stay? Or would the government say, well, it's okay if a Beis Din doesn't want to respect the automatic stay and it's going to summon someone to Beis Din, that's okay. They want to pressure somebody and they want to, you know, issue a contempt order against the person, even though they're subject to an automatic stay and they're a bankruptcy debtor, that the Beis Din is going to allow creditors to put pressure on this individual, that's okay. If the creditors put pressure on the bankruptcy debtor, as long as it's in a religious context, then we're okay with that. Do you think that's their perspective? Well, these cases indicate very clearly, if there was any doubt about that, so this recent spate of court cases indicates they care very, very much. If they care very, very much, so therefore we have to worry, even from a jurisdictional perspective, when it comes to issuing a summons or threatening to issue a seiruv or issuing an injunction, an ikul, I already said that our practice is that we don't issue ikulim if we don't have jurisdiction to begin with, but when it comes, but other bati din, as you can see, don't have that practice. But when it comes to any of those questions, I think that you have to take into consideration this dinin de malchusa dinin principle, that it's something that the government is makbid about. So therefore, my own practice, you know, in the Bati Din in which I've been involved, is that if there is an automatic stay, we say we're not going to send the hazmana. We can't issue a summons in a case where there's an automatic stay. That's a case where, because of the bankruptcy proceeding, there is the right for the creditors to pursue the case in secular court. Now, in secular court, they can't bring the action either. All that they're doing is filing a proof of claim. Filing a proof of claim is like the Ksam Sofer's case, where you just want to register that you have a claim so you're not going to lose it for the future. There's no issur al kos. There's also no issur al kos, because who was the first one who went to secular court? The bankruptcy debtor. They weren't initiating an action. It wouldn't be an issur al kos for them to go to secular court to begin with, but because they were the first one there, the creditor certainly isn't doing anything wrong at that point in just registering their claim and going along with whatever the secular court process is going to be. So therefore, and certainly when the Beis Din authorizes, if you would say, according to the Kli Chemda, who says that whenever the Beis Din can't handle the case at all, so there's no issur al kos, so there's nothing to discuss, it's perfectly fine. According to the Chassam Sofer, who says that the heter al kos, the ability to utilize secular court, would only be in an instance where the secular court is serving as the shliach, as the agent of the Beis Din, so then it would be appropriate, at least for the debtor, for the creditor, to come to Beis Din first and say, what should I do in this case? I'd like to issue hazmana. And the Beis Din can say, it's okay, we're not going to issue hazmana because of the automatic stay, but we authorize you to file a proof of claim and to do whatever you need to do within the confines of the bankruptcy court, which is currently handling the case. So that's how the case really should be, you know, handled. But let's say we have a case like we have in question number one. I think we're going to spend some time on the on this particular handout for next week as well. But let's say you had a case like case number one, where only part of the debt, only half of the debtor had declared bankruptcy. That the debtor consists of the Shimon's corporation and Shimon himself. But Shimon himself declared bankruptcy. We had such a case in the Beis Din. We had such a case maybe a couple of years ago in the Beis Din. So what did we do? We said that there's a right to sue Shimon's corporation. Okay, there actually wasn't even an arbitration agreement, an arbitration dispute resolution clause that the parties had in their contract. That if they would ever have a dispute, then they would come to Beis Din. So he said, with respect to that dispute, it's appropriate to come to Beis Din. But Beis Din had to be very, very careful, even though the debtors themselves were there in the Beis Din as the representative, with the principals of the corporation, it was important not to go after the debtors themselves. I remember there was one point in the Din Torah itself. Let me just check on the time. Oh, we have to stop. There was one point in the case itself in which somebody wanted to put pressure on the parties themselves in their individual capacities, and I said, can't do that, only with respect to the corporation. Okay, stop here.